with four or more separate meetings spread over a few days. I'm most comfortable eating homemade cookies and watching the Die Hard canon while my wife shouts advice to the characters on screen. This was not my world. Just driving into the parking lot was humbling. I'd be in a bare-bones rental car surrounded by shiny six-figure automobiles. The lobbies were always an indescribable combination of low-key and utterly terrifying. The furniture didn't look ostentatious, but it clearly cost a fortune. The names of companies and founders on the walls weren't flashy, but were meant to impress upon visitors the billions of dollars of wealth that had come through these premises. To me, these complexes were always asking, "Who the F do you think you are coming here?" I can't imagine how doubly intimidating it would be as a woman founder, or a founder of color, to see only white, and a few Asian, men on the staff, in the magazines of the coffee table, and celebrated on those walls highlighting great exits. Usually, the partner I was meeting was running 10 to 20 minutes late, so I'd wait in the lobby, willing my resolve to stay cool, calm, and confident, double-checking my notes about their bio, past companies, current deals, and anything they'd written or published. The meetings were always an hour, minus whatever time had been lost up front. If we started 20 minutes late, we went 40 minutes. Maybe that alone was a bad sign for me. I'd assume the more interesting deals got the overage. But the fascinating part came at the end of the meeting, or in the email follow-up from the investors who seemed genuinely interested. They'd tell me, or I'd ask, to speak to some of their portfolio CEOs and ask about their value as a partner and their support as a firm. Every VC believed himself, or, in unfortunately only two cases out of almost 50, herself, to have strong references from their CEOs. I diligently followed up every time and talked to at least two or three CEOs funded by a dozen or so venture firms. Of those, the majority did have good, though not always glowingly positive, things to say. And even though it was my first time speaking to these CEOs, many were happy to give me an honest and surprisingly cold or even directly negative feedback about their investors. I found this disconnect between the confidence of the partner and the honesty of the founder or CEO valuable and refreshing. If you go down the venture funding path, make sure you do the same. And for those of you who get funded or who already are, please carry on this tradition of putting your fellow entrepreneurs first. It helps make the landmine-laden game of startup investment a little less dangerous and a little more camaraderie-filled. It's not just this closeness and rapport among founders or the reputation VCs inherit that makes them, more often than not, fair players in the startup game. Deal flow is the other component. In the movie The Social Network, Mark Zuckerberg, portrayed by Jesse Eisenberg, insults a group of investors who hope to put money into Facebook, citing his friend Sean Parker, and walks out. It is indeed true that Facebook's founder arrived late to a meeting with the VC firm Sequoia, whom I pitched on behalf of Moz twice and whom, I'd agree, has a fairly deserved reputation for humorlessness. In his pajamas, the Facebook founder delivered a top 10 reasons not to invest in us pitch and mentioned Sean Parker, whom Sequoia had fired from the board of another company, Plaxo. That's an extreme example of a real phenomenon. VCs develop connections and reputations based on their actions, and when a founder or executive feels mistreated by their investors, word spreads fast. That mistreated founder and their friends are less likely to refer other startups to that investor in the future, and if a very hot deal that many VCs are interested in arises, those founders may opt to choose based on reputation and on references from their network. Thus, investors have a strong incentive, one tied to their future success in earning important and valuable deals, to treat founders and portfolio companies well. My experience with investor Brad Feld of Foundry Group could not have been more atypical. In 2012, I had one phone call with Brad on a Monday, during which he invited me and my COO to come visit Boulder at the end of that same week to pitch their entire partnership. We spent nearly the whole day with Foundry's four partners. Brad took us out to dinner. As soon as we ordered, he told us he wanted to invest. Then he spent another 90 minutes with us after the meal, talking about all the aspects of Foundry's involvement with Moz. I never felt that Brad was playing games with us, or that he ever treated us with anything but the utmost respect and friendship. He was a mensch that day, that evening, and ever since. One conversation in particular stuck in my head. I asked Brad how Foundry would react if we were offered a deal in the next couple of years that looked great to Moz's founders and employees, but didn't provide the kind of return on investment that Foundry sought. My recollection won't be perfect, but to the best of my memory, Brad said, "I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs over the last 15 years. Sometimes their first company goes well. Sometimes it doesn't. But I'm patient. I pick founders because they're people I want to work with, and I hope I get to work with them again. So if they have a chance to do what they want, we never stand in the way. My relationship is one that spans decades in companies, bankruptcies, and exits. It's like a marriage. I want to be there for richer or poorer." I've never felt so confident saying yes to an offer as I did to his. No such thing as a free round of funding. A question I hear often from aspiring entrepreneurs is, how much about my company will VCs really control? The answer is complex. Investor and founder relations are generally positive. There are always contentious issues, as there should be in a high-growth company, but when things are going well for the company, they're also going well between you and your investors. However, if things take a turn for the worse, and it appears the company is in serious trouble, one of the primary powers a board of directors holds is to replace the CEO. Sometimes this can only be done with the CEO or founder's consent, but other times preferred stockholders, aka investors, have the ability to remove you or your co-founder from the company even against your will. What seemed like a minor point in a giant contract signed in a funding event can have a profound impact on your relationship to your board and your company. I've spoken to dozens of founders over the years whose companies were taken away from them by their investors and boards. In some of these cases, it was probably a wise decision for the company. In others, it may have been a bad faith move that hurt the company's prospects even more. But as a founder, it's critical to keep in mind your motivations and how they align with those of your investors. Even when you all want only what's best for the company's survival, growth, and success, there can be varied beliefs about what will lead to that best outcome. Statistics are on your side. Founder-led startups tend to dramatically outperform non-founder-led startups, but being removed from a leadership role or from the company entirely is a real possibility founders must face. When you sign up with an investor, you'll agree to a lot of terms and clauses that can be a peculiar combination of seemingly unimportant and concerningly scary. I have three strong pieces of advice. First, do not attempt to raise money or talk to potential investors without reading Brad Feld's superb, transparent, and surprisingly fun-to-read guide, Venture Deals. Second, get your investors to explain each piece of the term sheet, the initial offer upon which the final paperwork will be based, to you. Then, get your attorney. Yes, you need one. No, your cousin who watches lots of Law and Order doesn't count. And, if you have one, a savvy entrepreneur friend to explain the same pieces to you. If the stories don't align, you'll have a strong answer to my third and final suggestion on this topic. Don't sign anything with anyone you don't trust 100% and don't believe has your best interests and not just their portfolio's returns at heart. This last one sounds more difficult than it is. Thanks to the interconnectedness of the entrepreneurial world and the general bias that startup folks have to put the interests of their fellow founders, even ones they've never met before, ahead of investors, reputation is earned and transmitted quickly. If your company fits the mold for venture or even for angels, outreach to other founders in your field or your geography is surprisingly effective. I've been consistently amazed at how willing other entrepreneurs have been to take my emails and phone calls, to make introductions, and to give their unvarnished opinions. Take advantage of this camaraderie, and if you manage to get funding or become successful, pay it forward and help the next generation. One final unorthodox tip. If possible, build your expertise before you build your network, and build your network before you build your company. Each one leads elegantly into the next. If you have deep experience and skills in a particular aspect of startup building or technology that makes an hour on the phone with you deeply valuable and valued by entrepreneurs and startup teams, you've got a clear, compelling path to build a powerful network. Assist a handful of people and companies with their issues as a consultant, a member of the team, or simply an outsider who loves to help others, and you'll have a built-in network to assist in your fundraising process. That network is what takes the fundraising process from near impossibility to potentially achievable. Yes, it's frustrating that the worlds of startup financing are a closed ecosystem, exclusive and walled off in their nerd paradises. But you can make friends with the gatekeepers, and once you do, the inhabitants can be surprisingly affable. Chapter 8. Founding a top 5% startup may not make you rich. Economically, you can think of a startup as a way to compress your whole working life into a few years. Instead of working at a low intensity for 40 years, you work as hard as you possibly can for 4. That's Paul Graham, May of 2004. About once a month, I get an email from an entrepreneur telling me they're seeking investment and asking if I'd be interested in learning more about their company. My response has been the same for years. Unfortunately, I can't invest in your company because I don't have the money. Hopefully, someday, Moz's growth will provide liquidity. But for now, I just own private stock. Wish you luck! As of this writing, my wife and I have about 2 years' worth of savings in the bank. She still has the used 2003 Kia Spectra she got in 2004, but I've never owned a car myself. I walk to work and back each day, often with an umbrella because we live in Seattle. Our apartment is only a few years old, in a high-density part of town, and plenty big enough for the two of us. We've even been lucky enough to help some family out with money in the past. But owning shares, even a large amount, in a private company like Moz, doesn't generate the kind of payout that many folks would assume. I don't share this story for sympathy. My salary is $220,000 a year, an amount that enables terrific freedom, the ability to help out family, and some reckless spending, mostly on travel, and helps us cover Seattle's insane rent prices. I share it because the startup culture has convinced many, many folks that if you start a company that turns into a multi-million dollar venture, you've hit the jackpot. That conditioning has been ingrained in the gold rush mentality of Silicon Valley geographically and of the tech startup field worldwide. But statistically speaking, this isn't the case. Even successful startup founders don't get rich quick. We've talked about how most startups fail, but it's not just investors who lose out. Founders and early employees are hit especially hard because they tend to take compensation below market rates for the first, riskiest years of a new venture. As is true across the economic spectrum in the first few decades of the 21st century, the distribution of wealth in startups goes massively, disproportionately to the few at the very top of the field. Conversely, a job at an emerging contender, think Box, Slack, Airbnb, Snapchat, in the tech world, or at a major public tech leader, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Facebook, can provide salary and stock that has a vastly better chance of making you a lot of money in a few short years. I'll give you a comparison of average tech salaries in Seattle from 2001 to 2015, versus my own earnings at Moz during the same period. In 2001, I was making very little, less than $20,000 a year, and the average software engineering salary was in the $65,000 a year range. When Moz raised its first round of venture capital in 2007, my salary skyrocketed to $120,000 a year, very close to the average tech salary around $100,000 a year at the time. In 2012, when we raised money again, my salary went up to $250,000, but I reduced it a year later in 2013 back down to 200,000 to aim for profitability. In the years in between, Seattle's average software engineer salary has grown at a steady clip and is now close to that at $175,000 a year. In case you're curious, my salary in 2016 was about $205,000, and partway through 2017, I got a raise to about $220,000. Seattle software engineering salaries have continued to grow, and senior engineers' total comp at late-stage startups with at least 10 years' experience averaged just over $180,000. But many would-be startup founders and startup employees have confusion about why, sometimes, ownership of a company makes the founders wealthy versus other times when it may not. Let's assume a scenario in which you're starting a very traditional startup, one with investors and a board of directors and the goal of a financial exit that returns money to those investors. Initially, you and your co-founders own 100% of the company. But once you raise money, the company will issue shares that are divided into several segments. Common stock, the kind you and any co-founders own. Preferred stock, the kind your investors own, which usually grants them some special rights like the ability to get their money out first in a sale and to have a seat on the board of directors. Stock options, the kind your employees own, which gives them the right to buy stock at the price it held when they were issued the option, usually when they join the company or get a promotion or bonus. If things go well, the value of your company will increase over time, and the stock should, accordingly, have more value too. But in reality, stock owned by you or by your employees, should they choose to exercise their options, can only be sold when there's a willing buyer. And willing buyers are rare. Imagine there's a supposedly valuable painting sitting in your attic. You put it up for auction, but no one bids. The painting may still have value, but it can't be turned into cash unless you find a buyer who wants it, is willing to pay, and has the liquid assets to do so. The same is true of stock in your startup. You own something that, on paper, has great worth, but it can't pay your bills or help you with the down payment on a house. Private companies, especially startups, are very risky investments. The 90% failure rate keeps most types of investors away from the field. Government regulations on who can invest in startups also plays a role. In the United States, in order to put money into a startup like the one described here, you need to be an accredited investor, meaning you have a net worth of $1 million or more, excluding the value of your primary residence, and or income of greater than $200,000, $300,000 if married, in each of the last 2 years. If the risks and the regulations don't keep buyers of your startup stock away, the fundamental attributes of private stock very likely will. When investors buy stock in publicly traded companies on an exchange like the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, there's a set trading price, historical data, and a wealth of information, required and regulated by law, available to everyone. In a private company, those requirements don't exist. The price can be set purely by the buyer and seller agreeing to it. No law provides buyers with a legal claim to information about the company's performance, structure, financials, or other data. Some private transactions may include information rights along with the stock sale, but these must be approved by the board of directors and add complexity and reporting requirements to the company, which can be a drag on the poor accounting or financial team, often an area with thin resources at a startup. For a variety of reasons, investors frown on private stock sales by founders, with some exceptions. Historically, they've believed that founders should be kept hungry, chasing that big exit, a sale or IPO, and knowing that until they do, the value of their stock is locked up. The assumption is that founders who have lots of money already will be less motivated to put all their efforts into the company's growth, and that a large payout may distract a founder as she tries to manage her newfound wealth. Your personal success, reputation, future employability, financial liquidity, becomes inherently tied to the company's. If the company sinks, you sink. But if the company succeeds, you, depending on how much stock you own and whether or not you find a buyer for it, might succeed too. Sometimes, if your company is growing especially fast and multiple investors are interested, but there's not enough preferred stock in a fundraising round to go around, there may be an unusual exception made and an investor will purchase private stock directly from founders, or, even more rarely, from early employees who've executed their stock options. But this rarity depends on a confluence of forces: an in-demand company with high growth, more appetite than availability for company stock from investors, and buy-in from the board of directors and existing investors, because even in these transactions, some special rights are often requested by the new shareholders. For example, board observer seats, quarterly informational updates that normally go only to board members, etc. But if your startup is making millions of dollars and growing, could you, as founder and CEO, bump up your salary or your bonus and profit that way? In short, no. At least not without the consent of your board of directors. The board sets the CEO's salary and approves the salaries and stock compensation of employees as well. This compensation is, in almost every startup, a function of the market averages. Worse, if you own lots of stock, even if that stock is illiquid, it's factored into your total comp and thus serves to make the cash portion of salary your leadership or board sets even lower. I have spent long hours trying to explain this to my brother-in-law to no avail. He repeatedly asks to borrow a couple million. Sorry, Ed, we really don't have it. Your investors have access to a diverse set of salary ranges across their portfolio companies, and they often buy additional data from aggregators of salary information too. Using these aggregated statistics, they'll help you determine compensation ranges for the company. Reasonable arguments can be made on either side. Being thrifty and relying on passion and the promise of stock option values to incentivize employees, versus ponying up the top echelons of salaries to compete for talent with big companies and other high-paying startups in your field. But arguing for a salary that's far outside these ranges for a CEO or founder will garner contention and almost certain disapproval from your board. It takes a lot of sevens and a long time to win at startup roulette. In essence, founding a startup or being an early employee means taking a risk. You're sacrificing the certainty of a potentially higher-paying job with greater benefits at a more established company for what is typically a less-than-market-rate salary, bare-bones benefits, and the hope that if things go very well and your company is one of the few that survive and thrive, your compensation will rise, the benefits will get better, and someday, if you're extremely lucky, your stock's value will exceed the delta between what you could have made in another job. It's a gamble. But because the stories we hear always focus on the big winners, the Zuckerbergs and the Andreessens, we tend to forget that. We also forget that startups take a long time to exit, much longer than what popular culture would have you believe. Moz itself started in 2004. 14 years later, it is still going strong. But despite moving on from what most would call early stage to mid stage, has neither graduated out of the startup need for rapid growth, nor returned money to its investors or employees. In many ways, Moz is a lucky outlier. The majority of startup founders' efforts fail entirely. But we are a great example of how foolish the idea that you can invest 4 years and become a millionaire is. For all these reasons and more, it's often the case that founders of startups, even those that appear from the outside to be massively successful, raising large amounts of funding, growing at a fast clip, making a lot of money, may be, at least until or unless an exit arrives, financially worse off than their counterparts working mid-level jobs at a traditional firm. The venture capitalist and blogger Mark Suster gives wise advice to founders on how to talk about options with their team. We give out stock options. I hope they're worth money to you someday, but let them be icing on the cake. If they pay off handsomely, that's great, but don't count on it. Don't let it be your motivator or your driving decision. This same advice should be taken just as strongly by founders themselves. Your stock's value can blind you to the reality that private company stock is very difficult to sell, rarely appraised similarly to your investors' stakes in your company, and, if that sale ever does come to pass, it's reliant on forces largely beyond your control. I've met plenty of people who've taken pay cuts to work at startups and then found out their stock is worth nothing. It's happened to my friends and colleagues and even to my wife. Does this mean you shouldn't found a startup or join an early stage company? No, but it means you almost certainly shouldn't do it exclusively for the promise of short-term wealth. The idea that you can compress an entire career into a few years of work and be directly or consistently rewarded with cash for that compression is insanity, borne out over and over by the stats. Yes, startups have better odds than the lottery, but they're dramatically worse than put it all on red at the casino. The myth that founders get rich has brought thousands of people into the world of startups, potentially for the wrong reasons and almost certainly with the wrong expectations. There are logical, wonderful reasons to start a company or to join a risky early-stage venture. Chief among these is the freedom early-stage companies provide, especially to founders, to determine what you work on, how to structure that work, who to hire, who to keep on the team, and how every aspect of your organization will operate. Plus, you might have an idea, a product, or a mission that you really want to share with the world. It's an immense, stressful responsibility, but it's also intensely rewarding when it works. And, many times, even when it doesn't. One of the great things startups can do is massively accelerate your career path. If you've felt trapped in positions that don't challenge you, or constrain your earnings, or influence potential, a few years at a startup, even one that ultimately fails, can dramatically shift that reality. Early stage companies need people who are self-motivated, mission-driven, and can get immense amounts of work done in short periods by working very hard, by being efficient with their time, or both. Demonstrating that you have strategic vision, the ability to execute, and the qualities needed to recruit, motivate, and lead will make you a rare, desirable commodity in the modern economy. One of the reasons so many early stage companies sell in small acquisitions, often called acqui-hires, is precisely to get these proven, self-driven, multi-talented people on board. Moz has completed 6 transactions to accomplish precisely this. One of those was a young man who just graduated college, but had built a useful product in his spare time at school that proved to me and to our team that he could be incredibly valuable. We paid a small acquisition price, $18,000, and brought him on board at Moz at a salary with stock options and with influence greater than what we'd have offered a candidate who simply applied to a job posting. Another was a pair of SEO professionals who'd built a successful consulting practice and whose skills we wanted internally for our product and engineering teams. We paid $330,000 plus stock options and retention bonuses to get them here, a nice multiple on their business in addition to strong salaries and benefits. A startup can be a great way to visibly multiply what companies are willing to pay to bring you aboard. It might be a great way to level up your skills, and it has the outside chance of making you remarkably wealthy. Just don't go in blinded by the money. Most of the time, startups are a comparatively poorly rewarded labor of passion. Chapter 9. Scalable marketing flywheels are greater than growth hacks. Growth hackers are a hybrid of marketer and coder, one who looks at the traditional question of, how do I get customers for my product? And answers with A/B tests, landing pages, viral factor, email deliverability, and open graph. On top of this, they layer the discipline of direct marketing, with its emphasis on quantitative measurement, scenario modeling via spreadsheets, and a lot of database queries. That's from Andrew Chen's Growth Hacker is the New VP Marketing, 2012. At the start of 2009, in the wake of the Great Recession, Moz was in remarkably good shape. Following the successful launch of our Link Index tool, the team was frantically working to double down on our progress. But costs were holding us back. With greater resources, we could grow our data set and ward off any competitive pressures. Without it, we feared a well-funded copycat could easily take the market from us. I wanted to raise another round of venture capital to help us scale. I believed that, despite the awful VC climate, investment dollars going to startups had fallen off a cliff after the financial crisis of 2008, Investors needed somewhere to put their money. And Moz was a growth opportunity with a steady 2 years of rising subscribers and revenue. In the first half of 2009, I made multiple trips to the Bay Area from Seattle, spent thousands on flights, hotels, and rental cars, and, after pitching more than 40 individual partners at VC firms, had nothing to show for it. So instead, we turned to the now ubiquitous growth hack model in hopes of boosting revenue. That growth hack, in the form of an email marketing campaign, brought in a tremendous number of new customers and new revenue. But over time, I've come to wish we'd never done it. At least, not the way we did. It's just a little hacking. What could go wrong? Our hack started with the assistance of a pair of brilliant marketers out of the UK, Ben Jessen and Dr. Carl Blanks, co-founders of Conversion Rate Experts. Their specialty was taking poorly performing web pages designed to sell a product and massively improving the percentage of visitors who converted into customers. This practice, called Conversion Rate Optimization, or CRO, is a powerful, meaningful part of a web marketer's toolbox. It's easy to see why. If you improve your conversion rate, it has a massive impact on your customer and revenue growth. For example, for every 100 visitors who visit your site today, one buys something. But tomorrow, you make changes that double that to 2, or heck, just boost it to 1.1. Ben and Carl, alongside an equally brilliant employee of theirs, Stephen Pavlovich, who'd later go on to found Conversion.com and marry one of my employees, long story, the wedding was lovely, worked with Moz to design 3 things. An update to our website's homepage, a new version of the page that sold our software subscription, and a promotional email campaign. Their process sounds simple, but is both ingenious and remarkably effective. I implore you to copy it. Step 1. Ben, Carl, and Stephen asked us for contact information of 3 different types of Moz users. Paying subscribers, subscribers who'd tried Moz's products but left, members of the Moz community, who engaged in our blog comments and discussion forums, but who hadn't yet tried our subscription. Step 2. They conducted phone interviews and a few in-person interviews at conferences and in their offices, with several dozen members of each group asking questions like, what do you do professionally? What's your job title? What are your responsibilities? What made you initially sign up for Moz? What objections did you have, and how did you overcome them? For those who were long-term customers, they asked, what do you use Moz for? What does it help you do? For those who'd signed up but quit, what did you hope Moz would do that it didn't? What made you cancel your subscription? What would have made you stay? And for those who were free members of our community but had never signed up for our software, they asked, what holds you back from signing up? What would make you try Moz's subscription? Step 3. They used the answers to identify the right target customers for our products and to craft messaging toward this group. For us, these tended to be professional web marketers who cared deeply about their search rankings and search traffic. They were either consultants, independent or at an agency, or in-house marketers who worked full-time for a single website or brand. Step 4. They compiled a list of objections that those who'd frequently visited Moz but never tried our software had to signing up. They additionally built a list of reasons subscribers loved the product, descriptions of how they'd overcome objections of their own, and a long set of testimonials based on those interviews. Step 5. Stephen worked with us to design a new landing page that focused on addressing the objections we heard most commonly among the group that matched our best customers in terms of their traits and professional focus, but had never signed up. That new page was almost 8 times the length of the original version. You can actually still see a comparison of the two on Conversion Rate Experts' website via a case study they made. Step 6. Lastly, We all worked together to create a promotional offer that would go out to all the members of our community who'd never tried our software before. This list numbered nearly 120,000 email addresses. The new landing page was the first big win. When compared with the prior version, it converted visitors into buyers at nearly twice the rate of the prior page, a phenomenal improvement. To this day, I'm a huge believer in the power of conversion rate experts' objection gathering and objection addressing methodology. It's something I urge marketers of all stripes to attempt on their own landing pages. But good conversion practices don't fall under the growth hacks umbrella. Our email campaign, however, did. The original email from 2009. Hi, your name. Thanks for hanging out on the SEO Moz blog this year. I'm thrilled you're a fan of our work. As a special thank you for your support, here's a gift that will, in my humble opinion, have an enormous positive impact on your SEO performance in 2009. A full month of SEO Moz's pro membership for only $1. There's only one itsy bitsy teeny catch. Because we offer one-on-one Q&A with the SEO Moz staff, we've had to limit the number of places available at the discounted rate. So while we're sending this offer out to 122,451 SEO Moz members, it's only valid for the first 5,000 people who respond. Don't delay. We'll be promoting our once-in-a-lifetime $1 offer on the blog on Monday, February 9th. So act now before the riotous can't-be-tamed masses hear of this. To claim your first month of pro membership for just a dollar, visit www.seomoz.org/trypro and enter success09 as your promo code. The code expires February 13th, that's next Friday, but remember, space is limited. If you decide you don't want to claim this special $1 offer, then please send a reply to this email with a brief explanation of why you aren't interested. And don't worry about hurting my feelings. My wife says it builds character. I hope you have a prosperous 2009. Thanks, Rand. P.S. Here's the link again, just in case you missed it. Smiley face. To claim your full month of pro member services for just $1, visit www.seomoz.org/trypro using success09 in the promo code. In classic growth hack format, we made an offer with limited quantity to leverage scarcity bias, used a massively discounted price that was way below our usual rate, at the time $79 a month, and time-boxed the promotion with an expiration date. If the email sounds a little like one of those limited-time offer TV infomercials, that's no coincidence. The same tactics apply to both. On Wednesday, February 4th, we sent out 122,451 emails with the headline, Try SEO Moz Pro for just a dollar. And the reply to email address was my personal one. The result was, among other things, a 7-hour email marathon in which Geraldine and I manually replied to more than 2,000 messages. My poor wife remains uncompensated for many of the hours she poured into the company. Sorry, honey. That was an intentional move, designed to improve the delivery rate and to make it a more authentic offer. But it also resulted in thousands of email responses over the first 24 hours, most of them asking exactly the same question. Am I obligated to pay for the subscription after the first month? As a result, we quickly decided to send a follow-up email with the title, I made a mistake about the $1 offer email, clarifying that no lengthier obligation was required and subscribers who paid us $1 for the first month wouldn't have to pay anything else in the future. That email had an even higher engagement rate than the first one and drove a huge number of visitors and new signups. All combined, the two emails and a blog post the following week drove almost the full 5,000 new subscribers we said we'd take, more than doubling Moz's paid membership. By our estimates, the email offer and the resulting signups drove about $1 million in additional revenue for the business. It wasn't until later that I learned why growth hacks deserve the name hacks. They're called hacks for a reason. The email offer didn't make our product better. It didn't make our subscription stickier. It didn't help people to do their jobs better. It simply created a short-term boost of attention that led to a lot of complex, long-term problems. Among those, first, the subscribers who signed up via the $1 offer had a much lower retention rate than subscribers who'd signed up via a non-promotional offer. For years after the promotion, the remnants of those 5,000 promotional signups would haunt our churn numbers, one of the most important metrics for a SaaS business. Second, as a team, we became overly enamored with the impact this email campaign had on our revenue and growth. We spent years trying to replicate it through a series of aggressive discounting and limited-time offer tactics with middling success. In retrospect, an addiction to finding the next great hack dissuaded us from the long-term product and marketing investments on which we should have focused. And third, promotional pricing, especially when offered to a very large audience, creates an impression that discounts and special offers are part of a brand's ethos, and that rather than signing up at full price, you, as a potential buyer, should wait until the next promotion launches. We found that a large swath of the SEO community viewed Moz this way after our ongoing offers, usually 2 to 3 every year. If you've ever stopped yourself from paying full price for a brand or at a store because you suspect there'll be a sale in the future, you're familiar with the mindset. The conversion rate optimization efforts on the landing page for our subscription product, however, were an ongoing success and something we've continued to invest in with positive long-term returns. The CRO efforts of identifying the right audience, discovering their objections, overcoming those objections with information on your landing pages, and smoothing the checkout and sign-up processes aren't hacks. They're improvements to the fundamental flywheel powering our marketing. I deeply empathize with the temptation to chase growth hacks. Startup marketing blog posts and presentations are filled with stories of how one great tactic transformed the growth curve of a nascent business and made them leaders in their field. If you spent any time investigating this realm, you've probably heard the same stories. Airbnb's hack was to scrape Craigslist's vacation and rental home listings, then contact all of the owners and convince them to also list their properties on Airbnb. Or, according to some accounts, do so without even getting permission. Technically, this violated Craigslist's TOS, Terms of Service, the publisher's guidelines for how the website is allowed to be used. But it's now the stuff of legend among growth hackers of the startup world. They point to this story and argue that you can't make a growth omelet without breaking some TOS eggs. Dropbox's hack was a double referral system, wherein when a Dropbox user referred someone else to the service, both the referrer and the receiver of the referral got upgraded account benefits. For years, that growth hack was featured on marketing event stages and in blog posts across the web. The endless copycatting of this tactic resulted in plenty of frustrations as other businesses failed to capitalize the way Dropbox had. When Drew Houston, Dropbox's founder, presented his Startup Lessons Learned in 2010, he wisely noted that marketing tactics for one market type fail horribly in others. Dropbox itself had tried to replicate the growth hacks of other startups without success. Drew's deck walks through these many failures in paid search, PR, affiliate marketing, and AdWords. Hotmail's hack was one of the earliest in the web field and wasn't referred to commonly as a growth hack until many years later. If you were on the web during the late 1990s and early 2000s, you'll probably remember it. Hotmail's free email service featured a line at the bottom of every email sent, proclaiming that the email had been sent through the free service and inviting anyone who received the email to sign up for their own account. The rapid expansion of the web and of email itself led to millions of people taking advantage of this message in an era when many other email services charged a monthly or annual fee. In 2006, Yelp launched a hack that had an immense benefit to their overall traffic and branding, the website badge strategy. Yelp sent restaurants with 4 or 5 star ratings from their users a visual badge restaurant owners could put up on their websites to showcase their positive reviews. The badge linked back to the Yelp page, sending Yelp both traffic and, through the search engine's love of links, high search rankings for restaurant names, categories, cities, and more. That strategy had been tried before by TripAdvisor and City Search, but no one nailed the process more effectively than Yelp. And for years, Yelp rode the wave of SEO returns those badges helped enable. Side note, if it sounds like I'm unusually familiar with this hack, that's because it was my idea. Weird, right? I worked as an SEO consultant for Yelp at the time, and the badges with embedded links back to Yelp's site was a great way to improve their rankings in Google, so I suggested it. They approved and executed. Additional credit to Michelle Broderick, who worked on the project from Yelp's side. These stories aren't atypical. PayPal's $5 sign-up referral, Uber's many city-by-city hacks, the littering of referral cards, the unpaid posters in bar and restaurant bathrooms on Friday nights, the totally evil practice of faking ride pickups to their competitors so as to hurt their profits and response times, Facebook's college-focused growth tactics, for example, get the Greek systems on Facebook and everyone else will follow in the early days, and dozens more are pointed to by startup founders, investors, and pundits as evidence that finding the right innovative hack has replaced classic marketing practices as the way new companies can and should achieve sky-high growth rates. Like most stories of success, there's a kernel of truth surrounded by a mountain of hyperbole and oversimplification. Some growth hacks do work. Most don't. Even at the companies just described, the vast majority of individual growth tactics didn't take. Sadly, they don't get the press coverage or focus. The lesson should be, these companies tried dozens of innovative marketing tactics, combined them with strong, constantly improving products and plenty of traditional marketing best practices, and in some cases, a few specific tactics proved particularly effective as part of this mix. Instead, the shiny object-chasing narrative is the one that earns headlines and lives on in the subculture of technology startups. But if observing the life cycle and hardships of company formation and growth has taught us anything, it's to look beyond simple explanations for the deeper, more complicated truth. We should do that here too. Growing your startup's brand, customer reach, conversion rate, retention, engagement, and virality can include finding that one great hack. But to do that, you need a broader understanding of the problem you're working to solve. The alternative, sustainable marketing flywheels. Great companies are almost universally fed by a powerful, ongoing set of marketing processes that earn attention from the right audiences and bring them to the company's physical or virtual doorstep. I like to describe the complexities of the marketing process as a flywheel. This metaphor refers to a piece of machinery from the Industrial Revolution that stored up rotational energy from inconsistent sources in the form of inertia. This could then be used to power any number of systems that require a consistent output of that energy. I'll tell you how Moz's marketing flywheel works as an example. Our flywheel is powered by content that audiences in SEO find through a variety of channels. Search engines, social media, word of mouth, conferences and events, email subscriptions, referring links on other websites, etc. The process of creating that content, amplifying it through various channels, reaching new audiences via that amplification, and bringing people back to our website is a powerful ongoing system that drives millions of visitors and thousands of new software free trials each month. But like a flywheel, it took an immense amount of energy to get started, and only after it was rotating smoothly, growing its inertia, did it function in this friction-light fashion. Moz's marketing flywheel begins with keyword research and industry intuition. From there, We create content and publish it on our website and blog. We push that content via email and RSS subscriptions. We promote it on our social channels, and from there, it earns links and amplification. That helps us grow our social, email, RSS, and word-of-mouth followers. And it grows our domain authority. The content earns search and referral traffic, and next time we can rank for more competitive keywords. And the process begins all over again. For the first 5 years of Moz's existence, I blogged 4 or 5 nights a week. I'd take my intuition and my experiences from client work, online forum participation, conversations with other SEO professionals, and news coming out of the search engine world, and turn it into content of all kinds. I made written blog posts, illustrated visuals, PowerPoint presentations, live videos filmed against a whiteboard, webinars, statistical surveys, interactive quizzes, and more. And I put them on our website. In those first 2 years, I was lucky if anything I created received more than a few dozen visits. In 2006, after the success of the Beginner's Guide to SEO, that trajectory improved and I could regularly reach several hundred folks with new content, then 1,000, then more. The effects built on one another. The more people were exposed to something we'd created, the better chance it had of being amplified. Those amplifications, often in the form of links and shares, led to better search engine rankings, which drove more traffic and exposure, and generally more qualified visitors. No surprise that searchers, who are actively seeking out a specific answer or resource, engage at higher rates than those who've simply seen something of potential interest in their social, news, RSS, or email streams. This flywheel has powered our marketing efforts for years. It brings to our website high quantities of visitors interested in search engine optimization and web marketing topics. And through our content, we hope to instill knowledge of and trust in the Moz brand. Later, if and when those same people are seeking out software and tools to help with their SEO efforts, we hope to earn their business, and often do. In fact, an interesting stat about Moz's marketing and customers was uncovered a few years ago as we analyzed our visitor and conversion funnel. These numbers are somewhat older now and have likely changed somewhat, but retain this characteristic. Say you visited Moz for the very first time via a Google search for a phrase like SEO tools, then immediately signed up for a free trial of our software. Chances are good you'd be a Moz customer for less than 4 months, versus the overall global average of about 9 months. But if you visited Moz 12 times or more in a 3-month span before signing up for that free trial, chances are you'd stick around for 14 plus months as a paying subscriber. Whoa, I know. Turns out our best, most loyal customers tend to be those who spent considerable time on our website, participating in our community, consuming our educational resources, and testing out our free tools. Thus, it's actually in Moz's interest not to promote our products or conversions too heavily or too fast, especially to new visitors. The classic funnel optimization promoted by many marketers has this peculiar idea that we must race to turn as many visitors as we can into paid customers, and that any missed opportunity represents a flaw in our marketing process. Our metrics show just the opposite. If we want to have the best long-term impact on customer growth and retention, we need patience. We need to wait for our audience to be ready and engaged with us before we nudge them toward our subscription. I think this foments a beautiful, symbiotic relationship between our values, our content, and our paid subscriptions. We want to help people do better marketing. We want them to learn first and sign up only if our products are right for them. And our business actually prospers most from long-term, low-churn, high-engagement customers, the kind we get from deep investments not just in a visitor's conversion path, but in their professional and educational journey. Pro tip, if you have any type of subscription or recurring revenue, make sure you measure LTV, lifetime value, the total revenue customers spend during their relationship with your firm, by referral sources and by the number of visits prior to conversion. If your stats look like Moz's, you'll probably want to adopt a similar slow burn conversion process. The power of the marketing flywheel is clear to us, but it's not just Moz for whom this works. Of the most successful startups, nearly everyone has a clearly identifiable marketing flywheel that brought awareness and traffic from the right audiences and helped those people convert to a sale or a sign up at the right time. Dollar Shave Club, the famous Los Angeles startup that offers traditional men's razor blades for a few dollars a month, originally $1 until their acquisition by Unilever, built a funnel based on humorous online videos that positioned them against stodgy, expensive shaving product companies. Those videos would earn massive viral views from an audience perfectly poised to help them spread, usually young, heavily online, social media savvy men. The videos earned news coverage, which themselves got shared, and all of it combined to create a mass of traffic that Dollar Shave Club then bought remarketing and retargeting ads against, along with earning loads of high rankings for key search terms in Google. Zillow built a remarkable flywheel on the initial strength of their home price calculator and Zestimate, Zillow's patented formula for estimating a home's value. And the traffic, shares, links, stories, and controversies that inevitably followed. Initially, visitors weren't going to the site to buy houses, but once they began associating Zillow with residential real estate data, and once Zillow leveraged the engagement, content, and links to help earn high rankings in the search results, the outcome was inevitable. WP Engine, the popular WordPress hosting site renowned for its reliability, started by writing about and serving WordPress sites that had been overwhelmed by viral traffic, often to the point of going offline. By associating their brand and technology with the Reddit hug of death and other similar phenomena that overwhelm a site's web servers by sending huge amounts of visitors in a short window, and by appealing specifically to site owners whose domains had received this sort of popularity, as well as the tech-savvy crowds that often influence them online, WP Engine developed a cult following that led to broader popularity and traffic over time. While flywheels are critical to build, there is overlap between investing in them and experimenting with growth hacks. My experience has been that the best time to leverage a hack is when it perfectly fits with an area where your flywheel is experiencing friction. Early on, Moz's flywheel struggled most with how to get in front of bloggers, journalists, website owners, and influencers who might be likely to link to our content. I recall vividly how, in 2005, when a few websites linked to a piece I'd written, I stood up at my desk cheering and bought a bottle of cheap champagne on the way home from work. It might sound silly, but in those days, I knew that links to my posts were what stood between toiling in relative anonymity and earning highly relevant visitors who might become consulting clients. The friction in our flywheel was how to get in front of those who might link to us and how to convince them to create those links. The solution was to find a hack, the right hack, that could get us noticed by these specific sorts of website owners and bloggers and writers in the search technology and marketing fields. We found our hack with a piece of content we called the Search Engine Ranking Factors. To be fair, we were not the first or only website to attempt to list out the elements Google used to determine how sites and pages ranked via their famed algorithm, but we were the first to do it with a community-recruited crowd of influencers. Our approach relied on crafting a survey of all the various potential ranking inputs, then asking notable, professional SEOs to take the survey and contribute their opinions. The resulting document aggregated quotes, summed up and averaged numerical rankings, and then ordered them by relative weight. More than 100 folks with websites and followings of their own gave their input, and each received a personal email from me thanking them for their participation and asking for their help in spreading the work. This growth hack produced high-value content, the ranking factors document itself, and